pictures formed, at first blurred and indistinct, then growing vivid and real and with three-dimensional effect. We watched intently. This was the world of long, long ago. When the world was very young. Mountains stood where now there are seas, and the pleasant seaside resorts are now mountain tops. The weather was warmer and strange creatures roamed afield. This was a world of scientific progress. Strange machines rolled along, flew inches from the surface of the earth, or flew miles up in the air. Great temples reared their pinnacles skywards, as if in challenge to the clouds. Animals and man talked telepathically together. But all was not bliss. Politicians fought against politicians. The world was a divided camp in which each side coveted the lands of the other. Suspicion and fear were the clouds under which the ordinary man lived. Priests of both sides proclaimed that they alone were the favored of the gods. In the pictures before us we saw ranting priests, as now, purveying their own brand of salvation. At a price. Priests of each sect taught that it was a holy duty to kill the enemy. Almost in the same breath they preached that mankind throughout the world were brothers. The illogicality of brother killing brother did not occur to them. We saw great wars fought, with most of the casualties being civilians. The armed forces, safe behind their armor, were mostly safe. The aged, the women and children, those who did not fight, were the ones to suffer. We saw glimpses of scientists working in laboratories, working to produce even deadlier weapons, working to produce bigger and better bugs to drop on the enemy. One sequence of pictures showed a group of thoughtful men planning what they termed a time capsule, what we called the Cave of the Ancients, wherein they could store for later generations working models of their machines and a complete, pictorial record of their culture and lack of it. Immense machines excavated the living rock. Hordes of men installed the models and the machines. We saw the cold light spheres hoisted in place, inert radioactive substances giving off light for millions of years. Inert in that it could not harm humans, active in that the light would continue almost until the end of time itself. We found that we could understand the language, then the explanation was shown, that we were obtaining the speech telepathically. Chambers such as this, or time capsules, were concealed beneath the sands of Egypt, beneath a pyramid in South America, and at a certain spot in Siberia. Each place was marked by the symbol of the times, the Sphinx. We saw the great statues of the Sphinx, which did not originate in Egypt, and we received an explanation of its form. Man and animals talked and worked together in those far-off days. The cat was the most perfect animal for power and intelligence. Man himself is an animal, so the ancients made a figure of a large cat body to indicate power and endurance, and upon the body they put the breasts and head of a woman. The head was to indicate human intelligence and reason, while the breasts indicated that man and animal could draw spiritual and mental nourishment each from the other. That symbol was then as common as is statues of Buddha, or the Star of David, or the crucifix at the present day. We saw oceans with great floating cities which moved from land to land. In the sky floated equally large craft which moved without sound, which could hover, and almost instantly flash into stupendous speed. On the surface vehicles moved some inches above the ground itself, supported in the air by some method which we could not determine. Bridges stretched across the cities carrying on slender cables what appeared to be roadways. As we watched we saw a vivid flash in the sky, and one of the largest bridges collapsed into a tangle of girders and cables. Another flash, and most of the city itself vanished into incandescent gas. Above the ruins towered a strangely evil-looking red cloud, roughly in the shape of a mushroom miles high. Our pictures faded, and we saw again the group of men who had planned the time capsules. They had decided that now was the time to seal them. We saw the ceremonies, we saw the stored memories being fitted into the machine. We heard the speech of farewell which told us, the people of the future, if there be any, that mankind was about to destroy itself, or such seemed probable, and within these vaults are stored such records of our achievements and follies as may benefit those of a future race who have the intelligence to discover it, and having discovered it, be able to understand it. The telepathic voice faded out, the picture screen turned black. We sat in silence, stupefied by what we had seen. Later, as we sat, the light grew again and we saw that it was actually coming from the walls of that room. We rose and looked about us. This hall was also littered with machines and there were many models of cities and bridges, all formed of some kind of stone or of some type of metal, the nature of which we were unable to determine. Certain of the exhibits were protected by some quite transparent material which baffled us. It was not glass, we just did not know what the stuff was, all we knew was that it effectively prevented us from touching some of the models. Suddenly we all jumped, a baleful red eye was watching us, winking at us. I was prepared to run for it when my guide the Lama Miniadon up strode over to the machine with the red eye. He looked down at it and touched the handles. The red eye vanished. Instead, on a small screen we saw a picture of another room leading from the main hall. Into our brains came a message, as you leave, go to the room, comma where you will find materials with which to seal any opening through which you entered. If you have not reached the stage of evolution where you can work our machines, seal this place and leave it intact for those who will come later. Silently we filed out into the third room, the door of which opened at our approach. It contained many carefully sealed canisters and a picture thought machine which described for us how we might open the canisters and seal a cave entrance. We sat upon the floor and discussed that which we had seen and experienced. "Wonderful. Wonderful," said a lama. "Don't see anything wonderful in it," said I, brashly. "We could have seen all that by looking at the Akashic record. Why should we not look at those time stream pictures and see what happened after this place was sealed up?" The others turned inquiringly to the senior of the party. The Lama Miniadon up. He nodded slightly and remarked, "Sometimes our Lobsang shows glimmerings of intelligence. Let us compose ourselves and see what happened, for I am as curious as you." We sat in a rough circle, each facing in, and with our fingers interlocked in the appropriate pattern. My guide started the necessary breathing rhythm and we all followed his lead. Slowly we lost our earth identities and became as one floating in the sea of time. All that has ever happened can be seen by those who have the ability to consciously go into the astral and return, conscious, with the knowledge gained. Any scene in history, from an age no matter how remote, can be seen as if one were actually there. I remembered the first time I had experienced the Akashic record. My guide had been telling me about such things, and I had replied, "Yes, but what is it? How does it work? How can one get in touch with things that have passed, that are finished and gone?" "Lobsang," he had replied, "you will agree that you have a memory. You can remember what happened yesterday, and the day before that. With a little training you can remember everything that has happened in your life. You can, with training, remember even the process of being born. You can have what we term total recall, and that will take your memory back to before you were born. The Akashic record is merely the memory of the whole world. Everything that has ever happened on this earth can be recalled in just the same way as you can remember past events in your life. There is no magic involved, but we will deal with that and hypnotism, a closely related subject, at a later date. With our training it was easy indeed to select the point at which the machine had faded out its pictures. We saw the procession of men and women, notables of that time no doubt, file out of the cave. Machines with vast arms slid what appeared to be half a mountain over the entrance. The cracks and crevices where surfaces met were carefully sealed, and the group of people and the workmen went away. Machines rolled into the distance and for a time, some months, the scene was quiet. We saw a high priest standing on the steps of an immense pyramid, exhorting his listeners to war. The pictures impressed upon the scrolls of time rolled on, changed, and we saw the opposing camp. Saw the leaders ranting and raving. Time moved on. We saw streaks of white vapor in the blue of the skies, and then those skies turned red. The whole world trembled and shook. We, watching, experienced vertigo. The darkness of the night fell over the world. Black clouds, shot with vivid flames, rolled around the whole globe. cities flamed briefly and were gone. Across the land surged the raging seas, sweeping all before it. A giant wave, taller than the tallest building had been, roared across the land, its crest bearing aloft the flotsam of a dying civilization. The earth shook and thundered in agony. Great chasms appeared and closed again like the gaping maws of a giant. The mountains waved like willow twigs in a storm, waved, and sank beneath the seas. Land masses rose from the waters and became mountains. The whole surface of the world was in a state of change, of continuous motion. A few scattered survivors, out of millions, fled shrieking to the newly risen mountains. Others, afloat in ships that somehow survived the upheaval, reached the high ground and fled into any hiding place they could find. The earth itself stood still, stopped its direction of rotation, and then turned in the opposite direction. Forests flashed from trees to scattered ash in the twinkling of an eye. The surface of the earth was desolate, ruined, charred to a black crisp. Deep in holes, or in the lava tunnels of extinct volcanoes, a scattered handful of Earth's population, driven insane by the catastrophe, cowered and gibbered in their terror. From the black skies fell a whitish substance, sweet to the taste, sustaining of life. In the course of centuries the earth changed again. The seas were now land, and the lands that had been were now seas. A low-lying plain had its rocky walls cracked and sundered, and the waters rushed in to form the sea now known as the Mediterranean. Another sea nearby sank through a gap in the seabed, and as the waters left and the bed dried, the Sahara Desert was formed. Over the face of the earth wandered wild tribes who, by the light of their campfires, told of the old legends, told of the flood of Lemuria and Atlantis. They told, too, of the day the sun stood still. The cave of the ancients lay buried in the silt of a half-drowned world. Safe from intruders, it rested far beneath the surface of the land. In course of time, fast-running streams would wash away the silt, the debris, and allow the rocks to stand forth in the sunlight once more. At last, heated by the sun and cooled by a sudden icy shower, the rock face would split with thunderous noise and we would be able to enter. We shook ourselves, stretched our cramped limbs, and rose wearily to our feet. The experience had been a shattering one. Now we had to eat, to sleep, and on the morrow we would look about us again so that we might perhaps learn something. Then, our mission accomplished, we would wall up the entrance as directed. The cave would sleep again in peace until men of goodwill and high intelligence would come again. I wandered to the cave mouth and looked down upon the desolation, upon the riven rocks, and I wondered what a man of the old times would think if he could rise from his grave to stand beside me, here. As I turned into the interior I marveled at the contrast. A lama was lighting a fire with flint and tinder, igniting some dried yak dung which we had brought for that purpose. Around us were the machines and artifacts of a bygone age. We, modern men, were heating water over a dung fire, surrounded by such marvelous machines that they were beyond our comprehension. I sighed, and turned my thoughts to that of mixing tea and sampa. Chapter 6, the mid-morning service had ended. We boys rushed along to our classroom, shoving and pushing in an effort not to be the last one in. Not because of our interest in education, but because the master of this class had the horrid habit of taking a swipe with his cane at the last one in. I, joy of joys, managed to be first one in and basked in the glow of approval of the master's smile. Impatiently he motioned the others to hurry, standing by the door and cuffing those who even appeared to be slow. At last we were all seated, sitting cross-legged upon the seat mats spread on the floor. As is our custom, we had our backs toward the master, who constantly patrolled behind us so that we never knew where he was, and thus we had to work hard. "Today we will discuss how all religions are similar," he intoned. "We have observed how the story of the flood is common to all beliefs throughout the world. Now we will give our attention to the theme of the Virgin Mother. Even the meanest intelligence," he said, looking hard at me, "knows that our Virgin Mother, the Blessed Dolma, the Virgin Mother of Mercy, corresponds to the Virgin Mother of certain sects of the Christian faith." Hurrying footsteps stopped at the entrance of the classroom. A monk messenger entered and bowed low to the master. "Salutations to you, learned one," he murmured. "The Lord Lama Minyadonup presents his compliments and requests that the boy Tuesday Lobsang Rampa be released from class immediately. The matter is urgent." The master scowled, "Boy." He thundered, "You are a nuisance and a disturber of the class, get out." Hastily I jumped to my feet, bowed to the master, and rushed after the hurrying messenger. "What is it?" I gasped. "Don't know," he said, wondered myself. Holy Lama Donup had surgical things ready. Horses ready too. We hurried on. "Ah. Lobsang. So you can hurry," laughed my guide as we came upon him. "We are going down to the village of Sho where our surgical services are required." He mounted his horse and motioned for me to mount mine. This was always a difficult operation. Horses and I never seemed to be of one mind when it came to mounting. I walked toward the horse, and the creature walked sideways away from me. I slipped round to the other side and took a running jump before the horse knew what was happening. Then I tried to emulate mountain lichen with the tenacity of my grip. Snorting with exasperated resignation, the horse turned without help from me and followed the horse of my guide down the path. This horse of mine had the horrible habit of stopping at the steepest parts and looking over the edge, lowering his head and doing a kind of shimmy. I firmly believe he had a misplaced sense of humor and was fully aware of the effect he had upon me. We clattered down the path and soon passed the Pagokling, or Western Gate, and thus came upon the village of Sho. My guide led the way through the streets until he came to a big building which I recognized as the prison. Guards hurried out and took our horses. I picked up the two cases of my guide the Lama Minyadonup, and carried them into the gloomy place. This was unpleasant, a horrible spot indeed. I could smell the fear, see the evil thought forms of wrongdoers. It was indeed a place the atmosphere of which made the hairs stand out upon the back of my neck. I followed my guide into a fairly large room. The sunlight was streaming through the windows. A number of guards were standing about, and waiting to greet the Lama Minyadonup was a magistrate of Sho. While they talked I looked about me. This, I decided, was where criminals were tried and sentenced. Around the walls were records and books. On the floor, to one side, was a groaning bundle. I looked toward it, and at the same time heard the magistrate talking to my guide, "Chinese, a spy we think, Honorable Lama." He was trying to climb the holy mountain, apparently trying to creep into the Potala. He slipped and fell. "How far?" "Perhaps 100 feet. He is in a bad way." My guide moved forward, and I went to his side. A man pulled back the covers and before us we saw a Chinese man, of about middle age. He was fairly small and looked as though he had been remarkably agile, something like an acrobat, I thought. Now he was groaning with pain, his face wet with perspiration, and his complexion of a muddy greenish tinge. The man was in a bad state, shivering and grinding his teeth in his agony. The Lama Minyadonup looked at him with compassion. "Spy, would be assassin, or whatever he is, we must do something for him," he said. My guide knelt beside the man and put his hands on the suffering wretch's temples and gazed into his eyes. Within seconds the sick man relaxed, eyes half open, a vague smile on his lips. My guide pulled the coverings further aside then bent over his legs. I felt sick at what I saw. The man's leg bones protruding through his trousers. The legs appeared to be completely shattered. With a sharp knife my guide cut off the man's clothing. There was a gasp from the onlookers as they saw the leg, with bones completely shattered from feet to thighs. The Lama gently felt them. The injured man did not stir or flinch, he was deeply hypnotized. The leg bones grated and sounded like half-filled sandbags. "The bones are too shattered to set," said my guide, "his legs seem to be pulverized. We shall have to amputate them." "Honorable Lama," said the magistrate, "can you make him tell us what he was doing? We fear he was an assassin." "We will remove his legs first," replied the Lama, "then we can ask him." He bent over the man again and gazed once more into his eyes. The Chinese relaxed even more and appeared to go into a deep sleep. I had the bags unrolled and the sterilizing herbal fluid ready in the bowl. My guide dipped in his hands so that they could soak. I had his instruments already in another bowl. At his direction I washed the man's body and legs. Touching those legs sent a peculiar feeling through me, it felt as though everything was shattered. Now they were a blue, mottled color, with the veins standing out like black cords. Under the directions of my guide, who was still soaking his hands, I placed sterilized bands as high as I could on the Chinese man's legs, high, where they joined the body. Sliding a stick into a loop I turned until the pressure stopped the circulation. Very quickly the Lama Miniadon up seized a knife and cut the flesh in a V. At the point of the V he sawed through the leg bone, what was left of it, and then tucked in the two flaps of the V so that the end of the bone was protected by a double layer of flesh. I passed him thread made from the sterilized parts of yak, and speedily he stitched the flaps tightly together. Slowly, carefully, I eased the pressure of the band about the man's leg, ready to tighten again should the stump bleed. The stitches held, no blood flowed. Behind us a guard retched violently, turned chalk white and fell to the floor in a faint. Carefully my guide bandaged the stump and again washed his hands in the solution. I gave my attention to the other leg, the left, and slid the stick through the loop in the band. The Lama nodded, and I turned the stick once more to shut off the blood from that leg. Soon that limb was lying beside the other. My guide turned to a staring guard and told him to take the legs and wrap them up in cloth. "We must return these legs to the Chinese mission," said the Lama, "or they will say that their man has been tortured. I shall ask the inmost one that this man be returned to his people. His mission does not matter, it failed as all such attempts will." "But Honorable Lama," said the magistrate, "the man should be forced to tell what he was doing. And why?" My guide said nothing, but turned again to the hypnotized man and looked deeply into his now opened eyes. "What were you doing?" he asked. The man groaned and rolled his eyes. My guide asked him again, "What were you going to do? Were you going to assassinate a high person within the Potala?" Froth formed around the Chinese man's mouth then, reluctantly, he nodded his head in confirmation. "Speak," commanded the Lama. "A nod is not enough." So, slowly, painfully, the story came out. An assassin paid to do murder, paid to stir up trouble in a peaceful country. An assassin who had failed, as all would fail, through not knowing of our safety devices. As I was musing upon this the Lama Miniadon uprose to his feet. "I will go to see the inmost one, Lobsang, you stay here and guard this man," he said. The man groaned. "You kill me?" he asked weakly. "No," I replied, "we kill no one." I moistened his lips and mopped his brow. Soon he was still again, I think he slept after the exhausting ordeal. The magistrate looked on sourly, thinking that priests were crazy to want to save a would-be assassin. The day dragged on. Guards went and others came. I felt my interior crumble with hunger. At last I heard familiar footsteps, and the Lama Miniadon upstrode into the room. First he came and looked at the patient, making sure that the man was as comfortable as the circumstances permitted and that the stumps were not bleeding. Rising to his feet, he looked at the senior lay official, and said, "By virtue of the authority vested in me by the inmost one, I command you to obtain two litters, immediately, and take this man and his legs to the Chinese mission." He turned to me, "You will accompany these men and report to me if they are unnecessarily rough in their handling of the man's litter." I felt distinctly gloomy. Here was this assassin with his legs cut off, and my stomach crumbling away as empty of food as a temple drum. While the men were absent in search of litters, I rushed outside to where I had seen the officials drinking tea. In a haughty voice I demanded, and got, a generous helping. Hastily cramming tsampa down my throat, I rushed back. Silently, sullenly, the men filed into the room after me, carrying two rough litters, cloth stretched between the poles. Grumpily they picked up the two legs and put them on one litter. Gently, under the keen eyes of the Lama Miniadon Dup, they placed the Chinese man upon the other litter. A cover was placed over his body and tied under the litter so that he could not be jolted off. My guide turned to the senior lay official and said, "You will accompany these men and you will present my compliments to the Chinese ambassador and tell him we are returning one of his men. You, Lobsang," he turned to me, "will accompany them and on your return you will report to me." He turned away, and the men trudged out of the room. The air was chilly outside and I shivered in my light robe. Down the Manuel Akhang we trudged. The men carrying the legs first, then the two men carrying the litter with the Chinese. I walked to one side and the senior lay official walked on the other. We turned off to the right, past the two parks and headed on towards the Chinese mission. With the happy river glinting ahead of us, showing flecks of bright light through gaps in the trees, we came to the farthermost wall of the mission. Grunting, the men put down their loads for a time while they rested their aching muscles and looked curiously at the mission wall. The Chinese were very offensive to any who tried to intrude on their ground. There had been cases of small boys being shot by accident when they trespassed, as small boys will. Now we were going inside. Spitting on their hands, the men stooped and picked up the litters again. Marching on, we turned left into the Lingkor Road and entered the mission grounds. Surly men came to the door and the senior official said, "I have the honor to return to you one of your men who attempted to stray into holy ground. He fell and his legs had to be amputated. Here are the legs for your inspection." Scowling guards seized the handles and rushed into the building with the man and his legs. Others, at gunpoint, waved us away. We retreated down the path. I slipped unseen behind a tree. The others marched on. Screams and shouts rent the air. Looking about, I saw that there were no guards, they had all entered the mission. On a foolish impulse, I left the doubtful security of the tree and ran silently to the window. The injured man was lying on the floor, one guard was sitting on his chest, while two more sat on his arms. A fourth man was applying burning cigarettes to his amputated stumps. Suddenly the fourth man jumped to his feet, drew his revolver and shot the injured man between the eyes. A twig cracked behind me. Like a flash I dropped to my knees and turned about. Another Chinese guard had appeared and was aiming a rifle at where my head had been. I dived between his legs, tripping him and causing him to drop his rifle. Hastily I ran from tree to tree. Shots came ripping through the low branches and there was the thud of running feet behind me. Here the advantage was wholly mine. I was fleet of foot and the Chinese stopped often to take shots at me. I rushed to the back of the garden. The gate was now guarded, climbed up a convenient tree and inched along a branch so that I could drop onto the top of the wall. Seconds later I was back on the road ahead of my countrymen who had carried in the injured man. As soon as they heard my story they hurried up their footsteps. No longer were they tarrying in the hope of seeing some excitement, now they wanted to avoid it. A Chinese guard dropped off the top of the wall onto the road and glared at me most suspiciously. I blandly gazed back at him. With a scowl and a muttered oath which reflected adversely on my parentage, he turned away. We put on speed. Back at the village of Sho, the men left me. Looking somewhat apprehensively over my shoulder, I hurried on and soon was speeding up the path to Chakporai. An old monk resting by the wayside called after me, "What is wrong with you, Lobsang? You look as if all the demons were after you." I rushed on and, breathless, entered the room of my guide. The Lama Minya dawned up. For a moment I stood panting, trying to get my breath. "Ow!" I gasped at last, "The Chinese murdered that man, they shot him." In a torrent of words I told all that had happened. My guide was silent for a moment. Then he said, "You will see much violence in your life, Lobsang. So do not be too distressed at this event. This is the usual method of diplomacy, kill those who fail and disclaim spies who are caught. It goes on all over the world, in all countries of the world." Sitting in front of my guide, recovering in the calm serenity of his presence, I thought of another matter which was troubling me. "Sir," I exclaimed, "how does hypnotism work?" He looked across at me with a smile on his lips. "When did you eat last?" he queried. With a rush all my hunger came back. "Oh, about 12 hours ago, I replied somewhat ruefully. "Then let us eat now, here, and then when we are somewhat refreshed we can discuss hypnotism. He waved me to silence, and sat in the attitude of meditation. I caught his telepathic message to his servants, food and tea,